When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Thinks Twice edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I have with me Jordan Weissman of Slate.
Hello.
We are joined by the one and only Emily Peck of the Huffington Post.
Hello.
She's a senior reporter, she tells me. Which is
accurate.
Which is impressive. And we are going to be talking about all manner of VC blunders. This is how I'm thinking about this show anyway, is that venture capital is famously one of those industries where you fund like 10 different things and one of them works. And we're going to start talking about some of the other nine. And we are going to start talking actually about a company, Emily, which you're telling me isn't that much in the way of VC funding. It's more kind of even pre-VC, sort of angels and crowdfunding and Kickstartery and that kind of stuff, with a whole extra layer of sexual harassment built in.
Extra super layer of sexual harassment built right into the period underpants made by a company called Thinks, which was run until recently by a woman named Miki Agrawal.
Okay, so let's just stop right there. period underpants?
Period underpants, Felix. So back in the day, period underpants were old ratty underpants that you fished out of the back of your dresser and put on when you had your period, and you know, you didn't care what happened to them, kind of a thing. But the innovation of Thinks, and honestly, it's not their innovation, period underpants, like they sell, have been around for a while, and other companies do sell them. But their innovation was basically the underpants, they don't stain, you can wear them.
Well, they're black.
They're all colors.
Oh, really?
They have some technology built into the crotch. Do we say crotch?
Yeah, you can say crotch on the show. Yeah.
And they cost around $30, which it breaks my heart as a person.
What's the typical amount of money that you feel not like comfortable spending on a pair of underpants?
$4,
yeah,
maybe?
I feel like four is good.
I don't know. I think it's a commodity product. I don't need to spend $30 on underpants, but Miki Agrawal convinced a lot of women to spend $30 on these underpants. She practices.
And she also convinced a lot of investors to spend millions of dollars on crazy advertising campaigns and taking over subway stations and that kind of stuff.
Very successful advertising, I'd say. She got into a fight famously with the New York City MTA, the subway system, over these ads that they wanted to put on subways, which were sort of, I guess, racy. No racier than anything else, really, on the subway.
Well, there was just like a lot of vaginal imagery.
It was
just like, it would be like a slice of a grapefruit or like an orange.
Yes.
And you would look at that and go, is that what I think it is? And then eventually like, yep, that's what I think it is.
Yes, grapefruits, runny eggs,
runny
were a thing.
Yeah.
So, but those ads went viral and it was a beautiful thing. I mean, it was very 2015. It was very of the time.
And Miki Agrawal is this young, photogenic woman of color who's the CEO, who everyone's like rooting for. And she has this hot, fast growing company. And it's very feminist and out there. And
all of it.
And everyone's like, ooh, this is like sexy, awesome, new economy.
Yes.
She
calls herself the CEO. She makes a, you know, she's very out there. She says, I'm not like other CEOs who are all buttoned up. I'm going to say what I feel and what I mean. We're going to be super open. And also she wears big hats. That's just a side note. Big hats.
Also talked a lot about free bleeding. I think that got
her.
Free bleeding got her a lot of press.
Yes.
Just like not wearing a tampon. And that's something that made a lot of media outlets go, whoa.
Yes. So. I mean, the moment for this company couldn't have been better timed, because it sort of ties into a bigger thing going on. People call it period feminism, where feminists just are talking more about menstruation, trying to take the shame out of it. There's this woman in London who ran a marathon while free bleeding. She went viral. I mean, it's just the company was very of the moment. But as it turns out, Miki Agrawal, there were problems, big problems. And it goes back to her saying, you know, I'm not like other CEOs. I'm very open about everything. Well, it turns out she was way too open and you don't run a company like this. She crossed a lot of lines, as we're learning this week. There was a suit, a complaint filed in New York City against Miki Agrawal from a former Thinks employee, a 26-year-old woman who had headed up PR for the company. And she details just these incredible allegations that are sort of unreal.
There was boob grabbing.
A lot of boob grabbing.
A lot of grabbing
there was getting naked.
Yeah. There's a lot. So she would like strip in front of her own employees, yes. change clothes yes. in her office, which was all glass.
Yes.
It was, I mean, so when Felix and I were talking about this story, I think you too, our immediate thinking was this is just like the story of Dove Charney at American Apparel. It was famously lecherous CEO mm-hmm. Who ran one of the hottest sort of the moment clothing mm-hmm. brands of the early 2000s
yes.
and then just harassed the living shit out of everyone around him.
Yes.
And this was this bizarre CEO edition of what was happening.
It right.
seems, or according to this lawsuit, at least.
I mean, it's a good opportunity to bring up the fact that sexual harassment isn't the exclusive domain of men.
It's mostly
women,
men.
But women can do it too. And it's not really, I mean, with Dove Charney, he was in fact sleeping with a lot of the women who worked for him. There's no indication that that's what was going on here. The women who worked for Miki Agrawal in the story that's in New York Magazine that everyone should go read, it's excellent. They talk about she's really doing this to sort of show her power and dominance over everyone else. Like, she's doing it because she can get away with it. She's telling this, the woman who filed the complaint, like, show us your nipple piercing because she can, you know, and that's not about she wants to have sex with the woman with the nipple piercing. It's about something else, I think.
And is this a function of a broader, I can do whatever I like, move fast and break things culture in the new economy, which we can trace through to any number of Silicon Valley companies from Zenefits to Uber?
I'm so glad you said that, Felix, because this woman wrote a book. It wasn't called Move Fast and Break Things. It was called Do Cool Shit.
Including grab your employee's boobs. You know, it'd be cool if I grab your chest.
The name of her book is Do Cool Shit.
Yes, that wow. is the name.
Wow. Like, so you literally go up to a correct. Publisher and I want to write a book. And they say, what do you want to call it? I want to call the book Do Cool Shit.
Yes.
And they're like, really? Yeah, that's yes. the name of
wait,
the book.
So.
And they're like, and we want you to do a TED Talk right away. Because that's the vibe, right? That's the tech bro vibe. And she co-opted it as a woman, which initially you're like, yeah, you go, girl. Which I'm sorry I said that. I just want to apologize for saying you go, girl.
That's okay.
But
it's ironic.
But no, do cool shit is a bad thing. It's just, it's not cool. It's not cool. You run a company. There are some things you should do. You should have an HR department, don't you think?
Well, so here's the thing now. I think this is actually a big issue across startups is just the idea that HR and like all the rules come with it are sort of ancillary. They're sort of a thing you do when you're a little bit bigger.
It's one of those questions. And I think this is common to all small companies, not just the fast-growing VC-funded ones, but especially those, which is at what point in your hockey stick hypergrowth do you stop, take a breather, and start building HR infrastructure and that kind of stuff?
And I don't think that's something that like VCs particularly... Has there ever been a VC who's like, you know what I think the next stage of our growth is? HR.
Like, exactly.
Is that something, it's not something that's like prioritized because it's not something that's directly like monetizable, right? It's not going to get you to that next sale. And so in a lot of, you can see where the incentives are to keep putting that on the back burner, to be like, okay, we need standards. Like there's never a point where that's going to get you up the hockey stick further.
And the other thing is that in a culture which valorizes founder CEOs, a founder CEO has astonishing amounts of power, generally. Founders nearly always have quite a lot of power. CEOs nearly always have quite a lot of power. If you have both in the same person, the company just becomes an extension of the individual. And there's almost never any kind of effective checks and balances.
Not that, and that's what's really interesting to me is like the HR department, I mean, they're not there to protect the workers. They're there to protect the founder CEO. Like anytime you talk to a lawyer who works on sexual harassment cases, she'll say, you're having a problem. Do not go to your HR department. They're there to protect the CEO. They're there to protect the company. So it's really in the founder CEO's interest to have an HR department. This isn't like some radical act.
I should say, do we know for sure that they did not? I'm sure they had some version of HR.
No,
but, oh,
they,
no, none
they
at all.
Really didn't.
Nothing.
They really didn't. And oh. they kept on asking, when are we going to get an HR department? And then she would say, you're fired.
Yeah, essentially, yes. They've been asking for like a year and a half for an HR department.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like, it's kind of when you're, I mean, but you can see the thinking on the part of a founder CEO, because if your goal is to move that fast and break things or do cool shit, it kind of is a bummer to have someone whose job it is to tell you that shit's not cool.
But it's also that she was, you know, she would talk a lot about how this was a very lean company, that she would notoriously pay her employees pretty badly. Yeah. She would, it seems, really take advantage of the fact that most of her employees were women to pay them even less, and that it was only the guys who ever managed to get pay rises. And you can see how in her mind, paying a bunch of money to qualified HR people to sit around and do paperwork was not really going to be an effective use of precious liquidity.
Right.
Yeah.
And you see in startups too, ones that are growing fast, they might have an HR department, but they wind up doing just a lot of hiring, you know, and not a lot of the protect us from getting sued kind of work that obviously this company really was in desperate need of.
So just to wrap this up, Miki Agrawal is now the former CEO. She now has an ill-defined role at the company, but presumably she's still the biggest shareholder. It does not have a CEO, but presumably it will. And somehow, I mean, what do you think, Emily? Is the departure of Miki Agrawal the beginning of the end for Thinks? Or is this like, do you think it can survive this crazy turmoil that's going through?
What do I think? I think, I mean, it's a product. Well, there was a story in MarketWatch today, Thinks customers, you know, saying how disillusioned they are with the company over this. The problem, I think, the reason it might not survive is because the company didn't practice what it preached. It was supposed to be a feminist company. And then it comes out that the woman leading the company treated all the women in her company very badly. And the reason anyone was spending $30 for underpants was because they were $30 feminist underpants, right? And now they're not. Like, the brand is kind of off now. So you can just go and you can buy other period underpants. There's a company called Dear Kate that sells the same kind of thing. And they don't have the taint of the CEO making video conference calls from the bathroom, whatever.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
There's another company in the news right now, and I need to get this right off the top. Jay Parkinson is a friend of mine. I've known him for years. And he's like a perfectly good guy. Whether he's an effective businessman, I really don't know. But he's a doctor. And a few years ago, he decided to start up a company called Sherpa with two A's. And this was a cool perk for New York tech types, that instead of having to go through the hassle of trying to make appointments with your primary care physician every time you had a medical question or whatever, it was something much more connected and appified, and it was just on your phone, and you could press a button and you could take photographs and email them over and use Facebook to communicate, or whatever was most natural to you, and you would communicate with doctors that way, and they would catch things earlier and they would be friendly, and it was a little bit less sort of institutionalized and formal and stuffy. And anyway, the idea was that this was healthcare for
Millennials.
New economy millennials who like to deal with everything through their phones, which also saves money for the company because companies generally self-insure. And this kind of support isn't actually that expensive compared to healthcare.
Yeah.
And if you... There's a whole bunch of relatively simple conditions, not the super, super expensive ones, but what Jay likes us talk of as like the middle 40% of conditions, which you can e-prescribe quite easily and use actually much less doctor time. And that, anyway, it was an interesting idea, and it got a bunch of VC funding. Like millions of dollars.
And then.
Of VC funding.
And then the VCs.
And then the VCs broke it.
Yeah.
And so this is, and then it basically, I mean, to all intents and purposes, it went to zero. And it's fair to say, I've done a bunch of like reading about this. It is fair to say you really can blame the VCs for that. Just like in Thinks, everyone was really focused on getting as much growth as possible, that the VCs who bought into Sherpa really wanted as much growth as possible. And they kept on saying, hire a new salesperson. You're not growing fast enough. Fire the original salesperson. Get more sales, you know, more sales, new CEO to get more sales, and all of this kind of stuff, which, you know, doesn't really work in the healthcare industry. Well,
and yeah. So the problem was the VCs weren't healthcare specialized VCs. These were VCs accustomed to funding tech companies.
Exactly, and exactly what you were saying about, yes, you're absolutely right that there was something very trendy. Mm-hmm. There was a bandwagon that like consumer webby kind of VCs jumped onto the healthcare bandwagon when it seemed cool and trendy. And a lot of the healthcare VCs were looking at the valuations and staying out of those deals because they were saying this doesn't make any sense. And then the consumer VCs were like, well, we want to see like Facebook style growth. And then these companies would say, we're healthcare. We can't grow that fast.
Yeah. So I think this, the question I have looking at this story, right, is this an indictment of a certain kind of VC? Of, you know, this, you know, Sandhill Road, Silicon Valley, consumer tech VC trying to, what happens when they jump into a much more highly regulated, slower industry and the damage they can cause? Or does it raise questions about what venture capital funding is good for, period? Like that as a model, like which is it, or is it a little bit of both? Do you have to kind of question? I'm not sure.
And we'll talk about this more in the next segment, but absolutely, I feel it's both. And what happened now, and it's actually interesting you should mention regulations because to cut a very, very long story short, and we can give you some links in the show notes, there was a bunch of tension between the founder and the shareholders, the VCs, the board members, and eventually they were like, okay, basta, enough, let's just sell this company. Jay finds a healthcare investor who's willing to buy the company for $20 million, which would have given the VCs all of their money back. But the VC said no, because it was that dysfunctional. And eventually, they basically drove it down to zero, installed one of themselves as the temporary CEO who tried to sell it in a fire sale, failed. But because it's a regulated industry, this is really interesting, and because they had a whole bunch of contracts and doctors and doctor-patient relationships, he couldn't just shut it down because that would be illegal.
Yeah.
And so because of that, Jay was able to basically buy back the company for $1. He now owns it, or he doesn't own it, but he controls it. He rehired all of the people that had been fired. And now it's just being run as a normal company, which is trying to make pay its employees and make a little bit of profit, which is a much more sensible way to run a healthcare company.
Yeah. I think it's a real indictment of how the tech VC industry kind of works. And you see it happening all the time. I mean, the other great example is probably Theranos, right? I mean, I heard Kara Swisher talking about this on Recode, and she was like, basically everyone in the little like tech in the tech industry, in the press, everyone went crazy over Theranos, wrote these glowing articles. But at the end of the day, no one understood the business. No one understood healthcare. No one understood blood testing. And like, that's going to blow up in your face. And so every time these tech people get all excited about healthcare, they think that healthcare is just like tech. Well, it's, guess what? It's totally not the same thing. And, yeah.
And it's true that you really want VCs who understand your industry. I think this is the real lesson that we're learning here. Right now, I keep on getting emails and DMs about this new Y Combinator company, which is a sexy Silicon Valley art investment company, and they're trying to raise money to invest contemporary art. And I'm like, no.
This is like such peak, like, oh God.
and the fact is, like, there's a million people who've tried to do art funds. They have all failed. It's like a really bad business. But Silicon Valley, because it's got these incredible blinders, has no idea how little it knows about these things.
So I think it's like, it's sort
it's
of
arrogance.
Well, yeah. I think really. There's, you know, not all, I mean, a lot of them have had success in kind of a variety of areas, but I do think there is sort of a fox versus hedgehog thing, right? Like, it's the old Isaiah Berlin, like, you know, the fox knows lots of little things and the hedgehog knows one big thing. And like Silicon Valley VCs, I think, consider them foxes. They know lots of different stuff. They can kind of take their skills to any industry, but in reality, they know tech. They are hedgehogs who know this one big world of consumer tech that's incredibly, incredibly valuable. But because that's been the, like, the industry driving so much of the economy and so much innovation, they think they know, they have a wider skill set than they may actually do. It's interesting that, you know, the company that wanted to buy Sherpa, or the fund that wanted to buy Sherpa, was attached to a medical center. Like, they have a 20-year VC fund. They are themselves in the industry, and they have a 20-year VC fund that's meant to give companies the time to grow. That's just not something you see in the Valley, really. It's like that's just not, that would be completely foreign to their way of doing business.
Because VCs, by their nature, need to return their capital to their investors after 7 years or so.
Yeah.
And healthcare just has a longer gestation period and is very complicated, as a man noted recently, who I guess we don't say his name, but he did point out that health care and health insurance are very complicated industries.
I think we're allowed that note. Who knew? Actually, apparently Silicon Valley did not know how. We're one of the few. I do think, though, it is, you know, I feel like we're kind of piling on here, but like there are different degrees of, like, you know, part of this story I want to say is, like, I feel like, Felix, you're almost underselling how crazy the details are, like, of what they ended up getting VC funding from SoftBank, and the SoftBank CEO just, like, came in, and you kind of hinted at this, but, like, just fired everybody in one fell swoop.
There's this one bit of the of Jay's piece that he wrote about this where he mentions, oh yeah, because, like, Jay brought in a CEO who was raising a Series B while also being pregnant, and then the SoftBank board member literally, like, to her face said, well, how can you be a new mom and a CEO and raise money at the same time?
Which maybe brings us back to that other episode a few weeks ago where we talked about whether or not SoftBank throwing all this money around U.S. venture capital was a good thing. Like, maybe you want to stay away from them. But so I think there's something a little bit exceptional here. Like, it's hard to tell how much of this is just, like, a really, really crazy story, or and how much of it really tells, like, about kind of a deeper pathology, maybe. But
I think Emily is right. There is something almost unique about healthcare.
Yeah.
You need to know what you're talking about. You need to actually know your subject if you're going to invest in healthcare. And the VC board members would not have been upset and shocked at the rate of growth had they understood, you know, the sales cycle in healthcare. But they didn't understand it, and so they were shocked, and they did come in and start firing people and all the rest of it.
Which I think also, you know, we have this question about why do some parts of the economy not get as much investment, or some industries not get, you know, why don't they have the same, like, pace of innovation and whatnot? And maybe some of that is just because the investment model we've kind of relied on for the last 20 years really is geared to a very particular set of industries.
That's a great point.
And doesn't necessarily translate as well to other parts of the economy. I'm kind of just off the top of my head, but, you know.
So that's exactly what we're going to talk about in the next segment.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Jordan.
Yeah.
One of my favorite facts, which I pulled from a Paul Kudrowski survey, which he did, I think it must have been like 3 or 4 years ago now, but it was, I'm sure the facts haven't changed, is he looked at the top 500 or 1,000 fastest growing companies in America and looked at how many of them had VC funding. And the answer was like 10%.
Wow, really?
Something like that. Yeah. That we have this idea, especially in the media where, you know, everyone loves big money and big investments and exits and IPOs and all of this kind of stuff, that exactly as you just said, that we're used to this funding model where like if you want to grow fast, then you need VC funding. Empirically, this is just not true. There's lots and lots and lots of ways of growing fast without VC funding. And yet the VCs keep on looking at all of these places which can birth fast growing companies and saying, we should be in that.
Yeah. And so that brings us to the tale of J.D. Vance this week. You may know him as the author of Hillbilly Elegy. He's a, you know, a Yale educated guy who came from Appalachia, Kentucky. His memoir has been a new bestseller pretty much since it came out. It was supposed to basically explain white pain to coastal elites.
He's a Trump whisperer.
Yeah, he's a Trump whisperer. I have not.
He's also BFF with Peter Thiel.
He is. He worked at Mithril Capital. I've not read the book. I hear it's good. Anyway, at some point, I'm sure I will. But anyway, why are we talking about J.D. Vance? We're not talking about Trump voters in Kentucky. We are talking instead about this new project he's on, which he is going off to Ohio to scout, you know, the great Midwest and the plains of America for VC opportunities for Steve Case's fund, Revolution. And the idea is that there are all these companies out because so much of venture capital is focused in basically California, which I think it's like 46% of it or something, and then New York and a few other places. You know, most of the country, I think the rest of the country pretty much gets like 20% of the VC funding out there. He's saying there's probably some missed opportunities. We should go and try to, you know, pick them up, look for them. But he's also kind of framing this as a, you know, path to economic renewal for Columbus or Youngstown or wherever, you know, or Cleveland. Like, there's sort of like this social mission he's also talking about. And that's where I start to grate a little at this, partly for the things we were just discussing about the VC model.
Steve Case actually, we know he started AOL outside of the...
In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So this has actually been his sort of passion project, apparently, for the past couple of years. I spoke to someone who worked on it with him. So he goes around to Detroit, Philadelphia, to Buffalo. The person
Pittsburgh.
I spoke to said a lot of good things about Buffalo's resurgence. So, you know, this is something he's been doing for a while, and I guess J.D. Vance is sort of the perfect kind of showpiece to do a thing like this. And
but also, J.D. Vance is he comes from this world of venture capital. He used to work for Peter Thiel. And so a bit like we saw with Sherpa, like, they have this idea that venture equity funding is the solution to like problems which it clearly is not the solution to. And my general feeling here is that there are lots of really good companies in Ohio. There are lots of really fast growing companies in Ohio. And there is zero reason to believe that any of them would actually be helped by giving up a large chunk of equity to Steve Case.
Well, so I have a question for Emily about this. Like, you know more about what Case has been doing than I do, I think. So, I mean, has he had any big successes in this?
Apparently, yes, Jordan.
Okay.
Okay. I didn't know this, but Sweetgreen, do you know Sweetgreen?
Yeah, they're out of D.C., though.
Steve Case.
Yeah, but that was, so, what? Sweet.
I couldn't believe it. And then, and Shinola, which I had not heard of and still don't know what it is exactly, but it's a company in Detroit that makes, like, briefcases and other things
They're mainly a watch company, but they also do a bunch of, like, they're the classic, what Shane Farrow calls TQE company.
Yes.
The quaint experience. And so they do lots of, like, very expensive, handmade in Detroit artisanal things.
I heard there for the customers, they call them Henry's. High earners,
not rich yet.
You knew about that? I was like, what? Henry's? I've been dying to use the term.
So I think we have some skepticism about the degree to which venture capital is really going to save Detroit. But here's the flip side of that. Because, you know, usually these stories are not about the VC people coming out to the country and trying to find companies. It's about cities that have trying to brand themselves as like the new Silicon Valley of, you know, the Gulf Coast or the Midwest or whatever, right? And it never works.
Well, it worked for Austin.
Sort of. And like, but they also didn't like that.
Silicon Valley wasn't always Silicon Valley. Can we just say? It used to just be nowhere.
They also had research university that helped feed into. We can get into the whole debate. But yeah,
you do need universities. That's very obvious.
And so, like, usually this story is about cities trying desperately to find funding, and it doesn't work because there are actually a lot of reasons why kind of knowledge economy type businesses, why tech firms tend to cluster in these places. And there have been books written about this, about how you actually, in order to have like a thriving startup scene, you just need a ton of fucking talent in one place where you can find workers from different companies who have skills and hire across them.
But Jordan, this is true if what you're looking for is tech companies. This is not true if what you're looking for is Shinola.
When you get a guy who like is basically from Mithril and is from Silicon Valley going out there, he basically knows tech. So he's going out there, and if he's going to look for tech companies, he's probably not really going to be that successful finding them. At the same time, you're sending a guy out, then if you're looking to look for Shinola, who has no idea how to find Shinola, probably.
I mean, this guy tried to convince me that because tech has improved so much and we have, you know, you can work remotely, it doesn't matter where you are, it's very cheap to start a tech company anywhere, that now is the time to do this.
So if we keep it to tech for the time being, that's, I'd say, true and false. That we have seen Berlin become a massive tech hub from nothing in the past few years. Stockholm is a massive tech hub from nothing in the past few years. It is possible to create a tech hub from nothing in a relatively short amount of time. But like, number one, it needs to be a tech hub. As Jordan says, like, you can't found an individual company. You need an ecosystem there. And number two, it only happens in cool cities where lots of cool young tech bros want to hang out. And there are lots of reasons why you'd want to live in Berlin. There are like no reasons why, given the choice, you'd rather live in Columbus, Ohio.
Right. And Appalachia, which is sort of like the place J.D. Vance sort of makes his name with. Like, there's never going to be a tech resurgence in Appalachia. That's not happening.
Don't count up Morgantown, West Virginia quite yet. But no, I mean, you're right.
It's like, I mean, Rust Belt cities are cool, but I think there's limits.
My feeling is that he's not really looking for tech. My feeling is that he's looking for, you know, industrial companies, which America's always been good at building and growing, and a lot of them can grow fast. And I think they do exist in Ohio, and I think that Ohio will create a bunch of successful companies, just like North Texas is creating a huge number of successful companies and is making, you know, there's a vast amount of economic activity and growth there. I just don't think that those kind of industries lend themselves to VC funding. I think that it's much easier and more sensible for the founders of those companies to get good old-fashioned bank loans.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let's have a numbers round. I'm going to start because it just occurred to me that the perfect number for this round would be 149,999,999.
I can't even keep track of that number in my head.
Which is the number of dollars that Rupert Murdoch lost on his Theranos investment. Rupert Murdoch, that famous healthcare expert, invested $125 million in Theranos and then sold all of his shares back to the company for $1. Emily, what's your number?
My number is 6. 6 is the number of weeks off Starbucks will give its female baristas if they literally give birth to a child, which is nice. Everyone agrees this is nice. But the problem is, if you work in Starbucks corporate office, the number is 18. That is how many weeks off you get if you're a woman working in Starbucks corporate office and give birth to a child.
But corporate children are that much more fragile.
The babies are worth more, and that is why they get 3 times as much time with their mothers, is the only explanation I could come up with.
I mean, makes sense to me.
Right.
Jordan?
So my number is $5.4 billion. This is not a VC blooper. It's just like a regular old banking blooper. It's Germany's state-owned development bank, KfW, which apparently it just transferred about 5 billion euros to the wrong banks. And this is something it's done before. Like, it's just like a technical glitch. They just like sent the money to the wrong place. Like,
it's Germany. Oops. They'll get it back.
I mean, sure. But like, so much for German efficiency, right? What happened?
But more importantly, we have the one and only Kathy O'Neill with her number, because she can leave, but she can't really leave.
Hi, this is Kathy. I miss you guys. I have a number for this week. It's $4 million Canadian. And it comes from, if you remember, the sex toy maker WeVibe, which has agreed to pay out that much money after admitting that it's tracking the owner's use of the vibrator that could be turned off and on remotely, and which the data of that vibrator was sent back to the company. It turns out that people don't like it when their vibrator's data is sent back to companies without their really understanding it. It also turns out that other people in the vicinity could actually remote control use their vibrators. So that was also a kind of an embarrassment. Anyway, $4 million Canadian, I think it's something we talked about. So we should really keep up on this and see you guys.
So yeah, Mickey Agrawal, if you're listening to this, it could be worse. Okay. So I think that's it. That's our numbers. That's our segment. Thank you very much to Emily Peck, senior reporter at Huffington Post and all round just, you know, interesting person. Thank you to Zach Dinerstein and all the other panoply types who are involved in the production hereof, the June Thomas and Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers, and I'm sure there are more. Check out all of those Panoply shows at panoply.fm, and we will be raising a glass to you next week on Slate Money.